Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From the wilderness of Kodiak Island, Alaska, this is Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier with your host, Robin Bearfield. In a land full of peril and vicious animals, humans are the most dangerous predators of all.
As a state, Alaska has never had the death penalty. It was abolished in 1957, 2 years before Alaska became the 49th state in the Union. However, from 1869 until 1957, 12 male felons were hanged for murder, robbery, and other crimes. This is the story about the unequal application of the death penalty in Alaska and why capital punishment was abolished in the state. Welcome to Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Robin Bearfield, and I'm broadcasting to you from the heart of the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge on Kodiak Island in Alaska. The execution of a Native Alaskan man who went by the name Skutdu was the first recorded in the territory of Alaska, and it occurred on December 29, 1869, after an episode known as the Wrangell Bombardment. On Christmas night, 1869, Quartermaster Sergeant Jacob Muller at Fort Wrangell invited the villagers from the nearby Tlingit village of Old Wrangell to his Christmas party. When a Tlingit man named Lowen drank too much alcohol and got into a dispute with his wife during the party, Mrs. Jacob Muller attempted to intervene and stop the argument. During a skirmish, Lowen bit off the third finger of Mrs. Muller's right hand. In the following altercation, a soldier shot and killed Lowen. The following morning, Lowen's father, Skutdu, approached the fort and shot at Leon Smith, the first man he saw. Standing outside the trading post, Smith suffered several gunshot wounds and died 13 hours later. The U.S. Army officers at the fort immediately demanded the surrender of Skutdu and said that if he did not come forward by noon, they would bombard the village and destroy it. The deadline came and went, and the Army began bombarding Old Wrangell. The villagers returned fire with muskets, but could not match the Army's firepower. The villagers raised the flag of truce, and Skutdu surrendered. On December 28th, an army court-martial found Skutdu guilty of murder, and he was hanged the following day. The second execution in Alaska occurred on December 24th, 1878. In this case, the condemned man was John Boyd, a white miner in Wrangell. Boyd allegedly killed another miner, Thomas O'Brien, in a drunken argument over a woman. In another quick rush to judgment, Boyd was convicted and hanged the following day. The last two men executed under miners' law were Charlie Green and Boxer, two Native Alaskan men accused of clubbing Richard Rainey, a white rum salesman, to death. According to some reports, these hangings were lynchings rather than legal executions. During the gold rush days of the early 1900s, the population of the territory of Alaska grew rapidly. In 1899, Congress enacted the Code of Criminal Procedure for the territory of Alaska. Territorial judges, marshals, and district attorneys were appointed, and jury trials became possible. On June 6, 1901, brothers Con and Florence Sullivan and their mining partners Owen Jackson and J.P. Rooney arrived on Unimak Island, the largest island in the Aleutian chain. Unimak is located toward the eastern end of the archipelago and was an unfortunate choice as a place to prospect for gold. But bypassing the Klondike and the rich gold regions in interior Alaska wasn't the worst luck the Sullivans and their partners faced. The schooner Lizzie Colby transported the prospecting party to their selected campsite near an old cabin on Unimak Island, and the men began making trips back and forth to the boat to row their supplies ashore. After a day of hard work moving their camping and mining supplies from the boat to their campsite, they spent a final night on the Lizzie Colby before rowing their last load to the beach. As they drew close to the beach, Rooney yelled to his partners. He said he saw two men stealing their gear. The four men jumped into action, rowing as fast as they could to reach land. They then ran up the beach toward a creek bed in hot pursuit of the thieves. They realized everything was gone as they passed the spot where they'd left their camping supplies. Rooney ran back down the beach to keep an eye on the rowboat, and Florence raced to the cabin to check on the gear they had stashed there. Con Sullivan and Owen Jackson followed the trail along the creek bed, looking for the thieves and seeing if they had stashed a boat on the beach to make their getaway. A half an hour later, Con and Jackson returned to the cabin and met up with Florence. The three men decided to hike farther up the creek trail to find the thieves. The men split up to look for any sign of the bandits who had raided their camp. They searched for boot prints in the wet soil or broken branches on the small trees and shrubs where the thieves might have veered off the trail. All of a sudden, four shots rang out. Con and Jackson saw nothing for a few seconds, but then spotted the man who had pulled the trigger. He had been crouching behind a rock, but stood to get more accurate aim. Then Con and Jackson spotted Florence. One shot had hit him, and he lay dying on the trail. Con, Jackson, and Rooney quickly understood that they were no longer pursuing thieves, but were instead fighting for their lives and had to evade these ruthless killers somehow. The men rushed down the trail to the boat, hoping to get away from shore and go for help. When they reached the rowboat, a shot hit Rooney, and he fell to the ground. Several other shots followed in rapid succession. The two thieves continued to fire as they pursued the fleeing men down the beach. When the bullets began hitting the boat, the three men ran for it. They took several steps when a shot hit Con in the upper back. Con screamed, "Oh, Lord! Oh, Lord!" He fell on the beach, and the next shot hit Jackson in the leg. Jackson saw Rooney a short distance away and limped toward him. Rooney seemed to have given up all hope, but Jackson urged him to try to get away. Rooney did not move. "There's no hope," he said. "We're all going to be killed." Jackson finally decided to try to save himself, and he ran as fast as he could on his wounded leg. He climbed up on a bluff to better view his pursuers and watched one of the killers walk up to Rooney, point his rifle at the wounded man, and pull the trigger. The killer looked around for a few minutes, and Jackson knew he was searching for him. When the murderer failed to spot Jackson, he motioned to his accomplice, and the pair headed inland. Jackson immediately removed his heavy rubber boots and ran on his injured leg as fast as possible. He traveled all day, all night, and all the next day until he found an abandoned cabin. He stayed in the cabin for 3 days and then continued toward False Pass, a native village. Starving and exhausted, he finally took shelter under an overturned dory. He would have died if a group of prospectors hadn't found him. Jackson stayed with the prospectors for 2 weeks until they flagged down a steamship to take him to Dutch Harbor. U.S. Marshal Frank Richards from Nome met Jackson in Dutch Harbor and took his statement. The authorities soon traveled to Unimak Island to investigate the scene and look for any sign of the killers. Instead of fleeing Unimak Island after the murders, the killers remained there, probably believing that Jackson would not get far and would die from his injuries. At this stage, the facts become murky. One of the killers seems to have disappeared, and although they could never prove it without a body, the authorities suspected that one killer had murdered his accomplice so he wouldn't have to share the loot. On July 23, 1901, the killers stopped at a roadhouse on Unimak. By chance, U.S. Deputy Marshal O'Sullivan was staying at the same roadhouse and saw the killer stuff a golden nugget and watch into a leather pouch. When the deputy asked the man how he came by those items, he noticed his nervous behavior. The deputy searched the man and his belongings and found $681 and several items known to have belonged to the Sullivans and Rooney. O'Sullivan arrested the man, whose name he learned was Fred Hardy. Hardy's murder trial began on September 2, 1901, with Judge James Wickersham presiding. The jury returned a guilty verdict within 5 days. No one else was charged for the murders, and Hardy's accomplice was never found. Although Jackson and the investigators swore that shots came from two different directions, they could not determine who had been with Hardy during the attack. The investigators suspected Hardy had killed his accomplice, so he would not have to share the spoils. Wickersham sentenced Hardy, who was white, to hang on December 6, 1901. But Hardy and his attorney appealed the sentence all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court agreed with the lower court's ruling and scheduled Hardy to hang on September 19, 1902. Hardy was moved to Nome, and his jailers reported that he remained cheerful until the end. He maintained his innocence and even began writing poetry. Many of his fellow prisoners and jailers thought Hardy had lost his mind, and that was why he seemed so untroubled and peaceful. The execution of Fred Hardy was carried out as planned. Let me take a short break. I want to thank all of my listeners. I appreciate you, and I enjoy hearing from you on Facebook and by email. Some of you have suggested murders or missing persons for me to investigate and write about, and I follow through on every suggestion. If it's an unsolved case, I often cannot find enough information to write about it, because the police don't release information on unsolved cases. However, I put the information I can find into a file with similar cases, and I revisit these cases every few months to see if I can find additional information. Please know that I am not ignoring you. If you haven't joined the Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier group on Facebook, please join. You're invited. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons in the Last Frontier Club on Patreon. You keep this podcast afloat. Please join the Last Frontier Club for extra episodes and other goodies. My latest novel, The Ultimate Hunt, will be out soon. Very soon, I hope. I'll keep you posted, and once again, thank you for listening. In 1902, Homer Byrd, a white man, shot and killed his two prospecting partners in a fit of jealousy. He was found guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder and hanged in Sitka in 1903. In 1918, Milo Segura, an immigrant from the Balkan nation of Montenegro, shot and killed his employer in Flat, a gold rush town on the Iditarod Trail. Court documents referred to Segura as a black fellow, but confusion exists about his race. The jury found Segura guilty of first-degree murder, and he was hanged in 1921. A clean execution by hanging is no simple matter. The goal of hanging someone is to break the victim's neck, killing him quickly. If the rope is too elastic, the victim will fall and then bounce upward. A rough, abrasive rope prevents the noose from sliding down around the victim's neck at the bottom of the fall, causing a slow, painful death by strangulation. Strangulation deaths sometimes take 10 minutes or longer. If the drop between the length of the rope and the open trapdoor in the scaffolding is too long, the victim might be decapitated. The placement of the knot in the rope and the length of the fall are critical in achieving the intended result of a clean hanging and a broken neck. Since most of the authorities in the relatively small Alaska towns where capital punishment hangings occurred had never previously conducted a hanging execution, they made mistakes, and some of the hangings were messy, horrid affairs. In 1920, John Doe Hamilton, a native man from the Athabascan village of Shagaluk, was convicted of shooting and killing his cousin. Hamilton told authorities that his cousin's wife said her husband was beating her. After Hamilton shot his cousin and hid his body, the cousin's wife moved in with him. Hamilton spoke no English, and the court did not even bother to learn his first name. Still, the jury found him guilty of first-degree murder. Hamilton's attorney told the jury, "The man is guilty, and there is absolutely no reason which his counsel knows why sentence should not be pronounced." Hamilton was hanged in Fairbanks in 1921. Hamilton's body dropped too far during the hanging, and he was decapitated. Police arrested Constantine Beaver, who was also a native man who did not speak English, for the 1929 shooting death of a friend during a drunken brawl. 1 week before the beginning of Beaver's trial, the judge appointed attorney Thomas Drayton to represent him. Drayton filed a motion to delay the trial for a month so he would have time to prepare a defense, but the judge denied the motion. The judge told the jury that if they found Beaver guilty of the crime, they could return a sentence of either life imprisonment or a silent ballot. When the jury found Beaver guilty and returned a silent ballot, the judge quickly sentenced Beaver to death. A week later, three of the jurors filed statements saying the judge did not explain what a silent ballot meant, and they would have sentenced Beaver to life imprisonment if they'd known a silent ballot would lead to the death penalty. Unfortunately, the jurors filed their statements 3 days past the deadline for motions in the case, so the judge rejected them. Beaver's attorney reached out to President Herbert Hoover to request a commutation of Beaver's sentence to life imprisonment, but Hoover denied the appeal for clemency. Beaver was hanged in 1929. Again, the execution was flawed, and it took him 9 minutes to die. On September 4, 1938, Nelson Charles phoned the Ketchikan police and told them he had just stabbed and killed his mother-in-law, Cecilia Johnson, with a butcher knife. Charles led the police up a hill near town and showed him Johnson's body. She had been stabbed in the back and chest and sexually molested with an empty bottle. Charles said that both he and his mother-in-law had been drinking and were drunk when she said she was going to kill him. According to Charles, she tried to stab him with a butcher knife, so he stabbed her in self-defense. Charles spent 6 months in jail before the grand jury convened and issued an indictment against him. During this time, he had no defense attorney. Once an attorney was assigned to his case, he had little time to prepare before the trial began. Charles admitted to murdering Johnson, but said he did not remember sexually assaulting her. This was a crucial distinction, because at the time in Alaska, an intoxicated person could not be charged with first-degree murder. Still, a capital murder conviction could apply when a murder occurred during the commission of a rape. The zealous prosecutor told jury members they had to return a death verdict. He said any sentence other than death might mean nothing more than a 6 or 7 year jail term. Charles's lackluster defense attorney did little to help him, and the jury found Charles guilty of first-degree murder and recommended the death penalty. The Alaska Native Brotherhood petitioned President Franklin Roosevelt to commute Charles's sentence from death to life in prison. Such petitions filed in Alaska on behalf of white murderers sentenced to death were often successful. However, in Nelson Charles's case, the president denied the petition. The hanging of Nelson Charles occurred on November 10, 1939. John Gaffney, a young reporter who witnessed the execution, wrote a gripping account of the affair in an unpublished essay. The assembled group watched as Marshal William Mahoney brought Charles to the stairwell scaffold and secured his arms and legs. The following is from Gaffney's essay. As he finished the task, he stepped back a little. "Is there anything you'd like to say, Nelson?" he asked. We listened, as we had never thought a man could listen. Listened till our ears would burst. Listened while we expected him to say nothing, but hoped he would. We expected a brief negative nod of the head, but he spoke. His voice a half-sob, whispering barely more. "I am innocent of killing my mother-in-law," he murmured. "I don't want to hang. I still say I am innocent." His head was bowed forward. You could feel, if not see, the hot tears in his eyes. You could feel his trembling in your own body. As Mahoney put a hood over Charles's head, it got caught on his ear, and Charles softly said, "Fix my ear." Those were his last words. Mahoney signaled a deputy who flipped a switch on the wall. Hidden from the observers, 4 deputies each pulled on a rope. Only one of the ropes would release the trap, but no one would know which deputy was responsible for the execution. When the trap door opened, Charles fell and the noose broke his neck. In December 1946, someone murdered storekeeper Jim Ellen in Juneau while robbing his store. The police arrested 24-year-old Austin Nelson, an African-American man, after they found a check written by Nelson to Jim Ellen on the store counter. No one witnessed the murder, and no murder weapon was ever found, but a witness reported seeing Nelson in the store on the night of the murder. Despite the lack of hard evidence, the jury found Nelson guilty of the crime, and Nelson lacked the money to pay for the appeal. At the time, the territory offered no provision for a public defender for a post-conviction proceeding. During Nelson's trial, 42-year-old Eugene Lamour, also African-American, testified that he had spent much of the evening on the night of the murder with Nelson. Although he testified as an alibi witness, his testimony ended up painting him as an accomplice to Nelson in the robbery and murder of Jim Ellen. A jury found Lamour guilty of the murder and sentenced him to hang. Austin Nelson was executed on March 1, 1948, and Lamour was hanged on April 14, 1950, after an unsuccessful appeal. Due to a botched hanging, it took Lamour 13 minutes to die. After a long debate, the Alaska Territorial Legislature abolished capital punishment in 1957. Several attempts have been made to reintroduce the death penalty in Alaska, usually after the commission of a horrific crime, but they have all failed. A look back at history shows that the death penalty in the territory of Alaska was unevenly applied after 1899 when Congress enacted the Code of Criminal Procedure for the territory of Alaska. While juries recommended the death penalty for many white murderers, their sentences were nearly always commuted to life in prison. Only 2, Frank Hardy and Homer Byrd, kept their dates with the hangman's noose. After 1902, All of the people executed in Alaska were either racial or ethnic minorities. Alaska watchers, considering the territory for statehood, noticed the racial disparities in how capital punishment was handed out in Alaska. Territorial politicians knew they would have to abolish the death penalty before the politicians in Washington, D.C. accepted Alaska as the 49th state. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you to my patrons for your support. Check out the show notes for more information on how you can support this podcast and unlock extra episodes by joining the Last Frontier Club. If you haven't already done it, be sure to join the Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier Facebook group and chat about the podcast. I'll see you soon for the next episode of Murder and Mystery in the Last Frontier.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.